accession number 12368, Reel 2.
Mr. Clark, Reel 2.
We operated under a unit that was known as public 5PRS, Public Relations Service, under a Colonel Astley. The correspondence would be sent out to the desert, usually three at a time, in one shooting break with a lorry containing their supplies and bedding, and a conducting officer. It was the conducting officer's job to see that they were properly provisioned and that their dispatches and their dispatches got back to the cable point in Cairo. In the desert, we were completely free to go wherever we wished. We could talk to any generals. Normally they were very ready to talk to us and briefed us completely, both about future plans and about actions that had taken place. As a result, we were usually able to decide on what particular sector of the front to go. As I said, the cooperation of the army authorities was complete. We were, of course, subject to censorship back in Cairo, and sometimes this caused difficulty, but as the campaign continued, matters of friction between us and the censor grew fewer and fewer. We knew precisely what information was of value to the enemy, and of course did not include these in our dispatches.
What problems arose initially?
I think simply unit designations to a great extent, and any description which would help the enemy to decide what part of the front we were operating on. Our dispatches, written normally in the last light of the day, were somewhat scrappily written on some occasions, but as the campaign continued, eventually we were given trucks with a little awning, a blacked-out awning, into which we could write by lantern. I think by the end of the campaign and the time when we reached Tunis, our side of the war was a well-oiled machine. Though difficulties recurred in Algiers when new units came out when, and there were new censors who applied different rules.
What kind of different rules?
Well, these were really designated from the top by people who know real knowledge of the circumstances. I can't, in fact, precisely think of any particular one, though lists of it were provided to us. There again, it was usually a question of identifying positions, intentions, which you can do by the odd inflection of a sentence, and again of units.
Can we resume the narrative now? Because we broke off with you being at, I think, Mirza Matru, mm-hmm. with the bedraggled state of some of the people on the
road. Yes, yes. Well, then, of course, we withdrew again after the rather ragged battles that took place there, and we withdrew behind the Alamein line. During the build-up time, it was very heartening to us to see the way in which the workshops in the Delta were emptied. New whole divisions came up to the line. The Australian division was withdrawn from Palestine, into which it had been sent for a rest period. And in the time of the Alamein attack, it was a completely polyglot army. We'd even got Poles in the line, Greeks, they called themselves the Greek elite, I remember. We started building up camouflaged ammunition dumps. Tanks were simulated by South African black soldiers who built these dummy tanks from Hessian draped over sticks and a skeleton structure. At night, these areas, they even went to the extent of playing a record of tanks warming up, so the enemy would keep their armour in the south, whereas we might be intending to make a thrust in the north, which in the event we did at the night of Alamein. There were attacks out of Alamein by the Australians on what was called Thompson's Post, where they attacked and took thousands of Italian prisoners, and again weakened Rommel's force. I went out with a South African armoured car squadron, which was based in the Katara Depression, and we used to go out in the morning and see the Germans getting out of their bedrolls and doing their ablutions. We could have picked them up, but of course we were there simply to gather information about their strength and to find out whether they were changing their units in any way.
What impression did the South Africans make on you?
Very good impression. Strangely enough, they struck one as being a very academic crowd. They didn't promote their officers, except when they decided whether one man's degree, university degree, was better than the other. It was a curious way of doing it, but it worked very well. I particularly like the South African First Division under General Pienaar. He, in fact, had spent some of his time in Germany and had taken a German artillery course between the wars. He was a great man.
Why did you like that division?
They were just, I suppose, because they were hospitable, but they were also very forthcoming and very fresh. Fresh in their outlook and very, very keen and earnest in the way they each individually built up a little minefield in front of the slit trench and put down barbed wire. They were particularly good at scouting out activities of foraging ahead of the line and taking prisoners. And they were a very keen and, as I said, earnest young crowd. Where are we now? We're back.
We're in the preparations for Alamein.
Oh yes, Alamein. There was a hiatus between the Gazala battle and Alamein, it wasn't until September, the end of September, that Rommel attacked somewhat tentatively against us in the what was known as the Alam Halfa sector. And there, we with our dug-in tanks, we waited for the Germans to come on and then wrought havoc among them. I remember going out into the area of a called Dair el-Manasib and seeing this great junkyard of German tanks that had been destroyed. One little sidelight on it was that at this time the 8th Army people, if they were anywhere in the vicinity, would go and look at a German grave. It was the grave of the soldier of the Africa Corps Panzer Grenadier who had died for his Führer nearest to the Delta, and there his steel helmet on the Black Cross. And when we took it off, we saw that they had he had written in all the battles he had taken part in, and had penciled in Alexandria, which of course he never saw. I forget what the name of that chap was now. I have it somewhere. Gefreiter, a very young man. I wasn't, in fact, at Alamein for the first night, the first night, October the 23rd of the attack. I was in Cairo, which was, of course, humming with activity around the Great Pillars, which was the headquarters. There, we correspondents were allowed to see the secret map room, and we could see the arrows pointing to where the attacks were taking place. The first stage of Alamein, of course, didn't go as planned. Monty and one or two of his generals were in disagreement about the phase of this battle. The tanks were withdrawn, and a probing action set in further south in the desert to try and persuade Rommel to reinforce the southern sector at the expense of the north, where we intended to make our final push. In the end, it was just as I remember Alexander, Field Marshal Alexander, telling us, he was General Alexander then, that when you come up against a stone wall, you put in an iron bar and you get in among the cement and you probe it back and forward until part of the wall gives in, and then you all cave in after it.
He told you that in Cairo?
Yes, he did. Yes.
At some assembly of the war correspondents?
Yes, that was at a press conference. So then I don't know that very much after it was thought that at one time we should have demolished Rommel and the Africa Corps at Alamein, but of course Rommel was able to put up a very strong rearguard action all the way back to Tunis, but mainly because on the day after the breakout from Alamein, I think it was November the 5th, the heavens opened, and unlikely though it might seem, the desert was made into a muddy patch, which stopped our pursuit considerably. All the way forward, of course, Rommel fought this rear guard, but was not able to stand for any length of time.
You left Cairo to...
To follow up in the pursuit, that's right, yes. The pursuit went where it gave us no trouble at all. There was no attempt to for Rommel to stay in Tobruk. Mercer Matruh fell easily. Benghazi, he'd gone from Benghazi. The harbour had been mined and blown up, and ships, wrecks of ships were there when we arrived. The only time we were held up to any extent was again south of Ajadabia in the marshes, which was a ready-made defensive natural defensive position. But this we got through mainly because we had the strength where he had he was very denuded. Again, there was fighting fairly in the hill country as we approached Tripoli, with mined roads and mined bridges. We got into Tripoli without any trouble. In fact, I went in with the fourth Hussars, expecting a rapturous welcome from the inhabitants, but it was very muted.
Why do you think that was?
I don't know. I think probably they were conditioned, or they were really fascist to a man there. You know, it was settled by Mussolini with these Italians. The Highland Division came along there and beat retreat, I remember, the same night, which is a glorious sight. I and one or two other war correspondents went to the Grand Hotel there, the only really habitable place to put up for the night. When we saw that, we were shown the register, and a line was drawn below the German officers, and I think my name is the second one there. That page was torn out by a Ministry of Information man who came out subsequently, and I think is now in the archives of the press club. After Tripoli, there was the Marathon Line battles and the famous left hook which dislodged it. And after that, it was...
Did you report that?
I didn't know. William Forrest, my colleague, reported that and was in fact wounded in the battle. Then the progress through Tunisia with its olive groves, a great relief after the arid days in the desert. Went through Sousse and Sfax and saw these old archaeological sites of Sousse and Sfax, Septus Magna, Leptis Magna, Septus is what we called it, Leptis Magna. And we were only held up in the Enfidaville line, the great massif which runs south of Tunis. There again, if Rommel had had any force of any consequence, we could have been there to the end of the war. But in fact, with the help of the First Army on the eastern flank, Rommel couldn't afford to stand and withdrew further back into Tunis. Tunis, there was a line held about 30 miles out of Tunis by the Germans, an attack was mounted with a joint 8th Army and 1st Army force of two infantry divisions and two armour divisions, which, advancing on about a 2 mile front, soon made its way on an operation called Knife Through Butter, for some reason. And we arrived in Tunis, taking hordes of prisoners. So many of them, in fact, that the prisoners were simply paraded and disarmed and told to march back towards Algiers, which they did, to the prisoner of war camps. When we got into Tunis that afternoon, I remember the shock of the Germans who were out there walking with their girlfriends arm in arm, and even being shaved in the barber's shops, suddenly seeing British troops in the town. There was some attempt at fighting, a bit of sniping from rooftops, but of course the fighting collapsed, and Tunis was ours.
What impression did the German POWs make on you?
They were still very arrogant. I mean, as they marched to their... Well, I suppose to be expected. They were being marched unguarded to their prisoner of war camps, and they were singing their songs, The Horse Vessel and all the others. Nobody took a blind bit of notice of them. Except I remember one British soldier who'd managed to get a hold of a bottle of wine or something, and swigging this bottle, he made an attack on some of them.
Why do you think he made the attack on them?
Oh, just enraged, I suppose, just pent up. Possibly it was because of what he'd experienced.
Had you not liked the conditions in the desert? I understood.
Oh, yes, 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 I love them. In fact, there's nothing nice, nothing more primeval or pleasant than to wake up in the desert in the morning, in the first light of day, when the air is cool and the light is so clear. Of course, people's impression of the desert is a hot place isn't quite true. It's true that in the seasons of the dust storms, the Hamseens, it was a very miserable place to be. But for most of the time, it was the most pleasant conditions. The idea, too, that it's simply heat and sun isn't quite right. My abiding impression of the desert, even today, is of the great winds that blew all day long. They blowing the sand at you and baffling your mind at times. It was non-stop wind. Worse in the mornings than at night. The real desert, the real sand sea, doesn't start until about 150 miles south of the coast.
How did you find the morale of the 8th Army?
Very good indeed.
Even during the retreat from the
Gazelle? Even during the retreat. It was nonsense, to my mind, for Monty to claim that the army was broken and demoralised. It was nothing of the sort. We'd been out there a long time. We knew we were the match of the Germans. After all, it was the first front on which we confronted the Germans. And we'd proved ourselves. There was a little puzzlement at why we found ourselves retreating sometimes. This, I think, was due to some indifferent generalship. Auchinleck had great difficulty in finding proper divisional commanders. And even the army commander, General Ritchie, was a very bad choice.
Did you meet Montgomery?
Yes, yes, yes.
Where and when?
In Cairo and in the desert. I remember him just before we went into Tripoli. As we went by, he said, "Go on, all of you." He stood beside his tank, which had Monty written in Gothic letters on the side of it. And as we rolled past in a jeep by this time, he said, "Go on, all up the road, up the road. The Germans up there, they're shooting, but go on, up you go. War correspondence as well." He was a strange chap,
In what way?
His attitude, and the way in which he denigrated other officers. He claimed for himself a lot of success, which in fact he didn't have. As a war correspondent, I was privy to, for instance, to all the plans for the attack at El Alamein and Marath and other places, and saw that some of these weren't as successful as he advertised. They were forgotten. At El Alamein itself, Monty's plan was really rescued by his chief of staff, Brigadier Frederic de Guingamp, who persuaded him to do what you're not supposed to do in military practice, and that is to exploit a failure. Where it failed before, we went back to the attack and it succeeded. Marath again is another case in point where he tried the frontal attack. He was a great advocate of the frontal attack, Monty. And that failed, so we had to put in the left hook. And this again was done at great cost to vehicles and our armoured strength. There were so many broken down vehicles. I can remember them being dragged, hooked up and brought along by others.
So after the end of the Tunis campaign, you...
I was in Algiers for the AFHQ, as they called it, right through the Sicily campaign. And I only joined the 8th Army again in Italy when we had liberated the Foggia airfield.